Since 9/11, the Tunnel to Towers Foundation has been committed to supporting our nation's first responders and veterans, heroes who put their lives on the line for our communities and our country. Heroes like U.S. Army Major Jonathan Turnbull. Major Turnbull sustained devastating injuries at the hands of an ISIS suicide bomber. The complete loss of his left eye, a puncture to his right eye, he needed more than 20 surgeries and countless hours of rehabilitation. Tunnel to Towers paid off his mortgage and gave him a specially adapted smart home designed for his needs. He moves around his home more easily now. His home also gives him hope. With help from people like you, the foundation supports families like the Turnbulls. Join Tunnel to Towers in supporting America's heroes, our nation's catastrophically injured veterans and first responders, homeless veterans, Gold Star families, and the families of fallen first responders. Donate $11 a month to Tunnel to Towers at T2T.org. That's T, the number 2T.org. 95 cents of every dollar goes directly to their programs.
You're listening to the Buck Sexton Show podcast. Make sure you subscribe to the podcast on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Buck Sexton Show. On this episode, our friend Michael Malis, he is back. He is in action and he is ready to party. The White Pill is his book, which I have right here. I was assigned this as homework by Michael. And hopefully I'll get a passing grade. I did have to read like the latter half of it quickly, but I did read it. The White Pill, A Tale of Good and Evil. And I think there's a lot of lessons. There's a lot of great history in this, Michael, which I really appreciate. I think one of the areas, even for people in this country who think of themselves as history buffs or what have you, the actual history of the Soviet Revolution and more broadly, what was really going on in the Soviet Union is a massive hole in the education of American history, I think. And your book, again, right here, goes a nice way to addressing some of that gap.
I think that's also partly by design that there's this massive hole, because what we're taught in schools, we like to have a nice little narrative that there's the good guys and the bad guys, and the founding fathers were all the good guys, and the Brits were the bad guys. And then the North were the good guys and the South were the bad guys. And then World War II, the Allies were the good guys and the Axis were the bad guys. Now, it's clear that the Axis were the bad guys, but we're partners with Stalin. And if you start getting into too much of what Stalin did, all of a sudden that little good guys, bad guys thing falls apart. And I think that does an enormous disservice. As a friend of mine pointed out, which genocidal ideology should I be more worried about? The one that lost or the one that won? So I think it's important for especially conservatives who kind of often have this incorrect idea that things started getting bad 20 years ago and all these different organizations, whether the universities or Hollywood or Washington, were somehow co-opted by the left. This is not only not new, but what had been going on, especially in the 30s, it was so much worse and so much more depraved in many ways than what we're facing now, that I thought was important to put forward, you know, exactly what half of the world effectively went through. And it saddens me that so many people, obviously I was born in the Soviet Union, so many people and what they went through is being forgotten, when this is a victory that happened in the lifetimes of pretty much everyone listening to this show.
Yes, you could definitely argue the greatest, in terms of population and number of people, the greatest liberation of humanity to freedom from abject tyranny occurred in your lifetime and in my lifetime. And it's really not thought of in that context, I think nearly enough. I don't think people understand. You know, we have a bit of a cartoonish view. And look, I love Rocky IV. I'm not saying it's not a really fun movie. But, you know, the Soviets, I think in retrospect, are thought of almost more as, and the whole Soviet system, as, you know, poor, buffoonish, oafish. You know, yes. We have all this notion of the commissar, whether it's in The Hunt for Red October or, you know, any of the pop culture. It's always some fat Russian guy with a bunch of medals on who's like, I'm drinking vodka. And it's like these people were actually sending women and children and everybody to effectively extermination camps in Siberia and to mass imprisonment and to mass torture. And it's not thought of in quite that way. And I think your book explores that. I also think it's important for you to continue to tell people, why is that, Michael? Why is it that there's always a soft peddling of the Soviet atrocity?
Well, I think one of the big reasons, and I'm confident that you'd agree, is that so many people in the West had blood on their hands as a consequence. Despite what, you know, Politico and the New York Times might tell you, in 2023, there was never a strong Nazi presence in the United States. This was not a thing. You had the Bund, but they were basically kind of marginalized and a joke. There was very much a very strong, not just communist in the sense of, oh, I believe in communism as an ideal, but literally many people answering directly to Stalin and the far side of what later became the Iron Curtain. And the one time when they were accountable for their actions, the fact that, you know, we gave someone who's killed millions of his own countrymen, got handed the atom bomb and things like this. The fact that so many of these Western outlets are still in power today, are still treated with respect today, is, I think, a major reason why this is soft-pedaled. There's a great quote in the book that I found. You know, we were all told that, you know, the McCarthyism, you know, witch hunts, and, you know, a playwright, I'm blanking her name, she was like, but there weren't witches in Salem, but there were these communists. Yes. These were people actively and intentionally members of an organization dedicated to secretly and to violent overthrow of the United States government in the service of what had been at the time the most evil, or maybe one of the two most evil governments on earth. So it's never framed in that way. And I think I did what little I could do to point out exactly what it was that was so bad about their views. It's not that they're just, look, I'm for equality and, you know, buck, everyone has to have a job and we need more housing. Please, you know, it is so removed from that. It is defending people being tortured. It is defending children being taught in school to turn their parents into the police, even if their parents have retribution and kill them. It is starvation for political purposes. It is mass deportations of many peoples from their ancestral lands in order to break them and for the sake of the common good so that they're subservient to the state. None of these things are discussed in the West. And frankly, I think in many ways, it's a failure of conservatism where, you know, the worst thing that often is said about communism is that it's godless, but it's not just godless, it's downright satanic.
Yes, no, it goes beyond that. There's a sadism. And actually, that's for anybody. And there's so many really poignant anecdotes in the book. About, you know, for example, the little girl, this is from Michael's book. There's a little girl who is outside in a bread line. We always think of the Soviet bread lines. And again, we have this sort of mentality of it's people, you know, they're in the babushka and it's sad and they're in line there. It's like, well, actually the guy at the front of the line sees a girl who's part of the kulak class because they're all in line waiting for food, right? And hits her with a knife and kicks her in the stomach and she dies right there. A little girl who's starving that dies in front of everybody. And his response to this, as you write in the book, is, you know, well, you know, you never know where the class enemies are going to come from, right? Or there's some, you know, this is another sign of the weakness of our class enemies. There's no humanity. There's no decency. And that's just that's a vignette that I think exposes so much more of this. I mean, for example, the Gulag Archipelago, which people, you know, Orwell is amazing and gets a lot of credit, although Orwell was kind of a slowly reforming socialist himself.
He wasn't reforming at all. He was a hardcore socialist till the day he died.
Well, he went less socialist, I think I would argue. He was starting to see the problems of a socialist system.
He said explicitly, every word I write is in defense of democratic socialism. I don't understand it.
Like, democratic socialism. Right. Not
you're going to tell me.
Yeah. Not authority. Well, I mean, but this is the game they play all the time. Like, what's the difference between Bernie Sanders and Stalin? One is democratic socialism and one is, you know, socialism. So, no, I do think that there's some game that maybe it's false, but there's a game that's played with the moderation of what the socialist intent actually is. Sure. And Orwell recognized that a truly empowered socialist state, now national socialist state, but that would be a whole other conversation, too. Created the horrors that he wrote about. Anyway, I didn't want to get into the Orwell discussion as much as I just wanted to say Solzhenitsyn, I think, is as important an author and is probably assigned in school, you know, 1% as often, or, you know, 1/10 maybe as often. And, you know, Solzhenitsyn, I think, in the Gulag Archipelago, the thing that really strikes people is just how evil people in the system were willing to be every day, and it was nothing, and no one cares.
Oh, it wasn't just they're willing, they were excited. This was their chance to have power over somebody else. The people who were arrested for political purposes were told explicitly, you are lower than rapists and murderers because they're still people. You're an enemy of the people. And it was encouraged, and we see this still to this day in North Korea, you're encouraged to be cruel and vindictive and make them suffer because you're the good guys and they're something far beneath human. This was something obviously very mirrored in Nazi ideology. So it's extremely disturbing when you look at historically what these systems mean in practice. Right? Because, you know, there's this whole idea of what communism's great in theory, but bad in practice. What, everything's great in theory. What does that even mean? Like, what kind of idea is bad in theory? It is practice where you determine whether an idea is good or not. And when we saw over decades, over how many countries, what this meant for the average person, you know, children chained to cribs because they were handed over by their starving parents who were told the government can raise them better than they could. Who gave up on crying because they knew no one was going to come to pick them up. You and I and pretty much everyone listening to this show can sit all day long. And if we tried to like rack our brains for how sadistic we could be, we would never think of half these things because our brains aren't wired like this. We're not raised in cultures where it's considered appropriate, at least yet, to turn power against the weak and those who we don't like. And just do just the most vindictive, vicious things and pat ourselves on the back for it.
I want to bring this into our current context a little bit, actually. And I make the argument to people, and I can tell that it's really uncomfortable for them. But, you know, you and I were in contact a lot during the COVID and what was going on in New York and the lockdowns. And I try to remind everyone that there was, to your point about almost a glee, like there was a glee that some people took in the extreme of it all. And there was a clear joy that you would see in the eyes of people, just in the eyes, who were mask police, for example, walking around and or telling you, why aren't you close to me, social distancing. They took some level of joy in treating their fellow human beings as though they were unclean, one, and also that they could lord it over them in some way.
Yes.
And I say to everybody, you know, okay, yeah, it wasn't, you know, they weren't herding us off into camps. I mean, they started to do something like that in Australia. They obviously did do that in China. But it also was a virus with a real fatality rate, of, you know, 0.02, maybe 0.002, depends on whose numbers now you want to believe. Spanish flu had a 5% fatality rate in the United States. Back when 1918, 1919, 1920. So I feel like if people were willing to do that for something that wasn't that extreme, that we're actually much closer to falling into a full-blown totalitarian society in America than anybody had previously realized.
One of the big delusions I think a lot of people have is that America's magic in the sense that these things that happen in other countries can't possibly happen here. And I think a lot of people, especially on the right, when they looked at how their fellow countrymen acted during COVID, had a big wake-up call as to how many people really regard liberty as their highest value. And what we saw, and I learned in my research for the White Pill, is in East Germany, they had an enormous, the biggest informant network the world had ever seen, thanks to the Stasi, which was their secret police. And after the wall fell and Germany was reunified, just the beautiful, beautiful scenes and some of my favorite parts of the book, you know, the Stasi archives were opened and a reporter spoke to one of these former Stasi recruiters. And Buck, you and I probably thought, I certainly thought that, okay, here's how it works. They capture me and they're like, give me five names or else we're going to kill your family. And like, Buck, I love you, but if I got to drop your name to save my family, it's going to happen. And I think the situation would be reversed. You'd hold out as much as you could, but at a certain point you're like, listen, I can't sleep. You're threatening my children. You're threatening my mom. I just got to give you names. I just can do anything to get the torture to stop. That's not what happened. In East Germany, they were people who were just bored or lonely or just wanted someone to talk to or wanted to have the opportunity to feel important for once in their lives. So we don't have to speculate as to what it takes to get people to turn into informants and to be amenable to totalitarian systems. We've seen it historically, and we've seen it here during COVID. And I would hope people realize that this is far more pervasive and far more universal part of the human experience than even I would have liked to have believed.
You know, the there's a Solzhenitsyn story that I remember where there's a woman who goes into the, you know, this is obviously in the Soviet era. A woman goes into the effectively the local police station and says, you know, the constables, and says, because her neighbor had been seized, another woman, at night, never to be seen again, seized, but left behind an infant, like a, you know, 6-month-old baby. And she goes, the neighbor goes to the police station to say, you know, hey, is the mother coming back? If not, you know, should I step in and do something here to help out? This baby's going to starve to death. They arrested the neighbor. And when asked later on why one of these individuals, why they arrested the neighbor, the explanation that Solzhenitsyn heard from another bureaucrat, another police officer, was to save them the time. That was the attitude. It's like, oh, you're already here? We're just going to grab you because we're probably going to have to grab you at some point anyway. And you've already showed up to the station. So now you also go into the cell and you either go to Siberia or you just go up against a wall and we execute you. Thank you for saving us the time. That was the attitude. And, you know, obviously that's a lethal matter and it's particularly depraved, but I really did get the sense, and I know people get mad at me when I say this, I get the sense that there were a lot of people who during COVID in this country not only would have complied with, but would have felt, here's maybe a better way of putting it, Michael. There were people who were openly celebrating when other human beings died of a virus because they thought that they represented the anti-Fauci point of view. That was widespread.
Yes. Explicit and constant. But look, to that point with that baby, the other reason for arrest is this is a country where kids are treated well. That's the narrative. So if you're pointing out an example where kids are treated poorly, you're a provocateur. You're a troublemaker. Come with me. So what happens in these systems is pointing out hypocrisies or problems with the status quo in and of itself labels you as a counter-revolutionary. So everyone very quickly has to learn to keep their heads down and keep their mouths shut. And this is something that those of us coming from there, it's just very weird to me talking to people who've been raised in like complete Americans, because a lot of times they'll say things that's just so different from how I was raised. And it's just things that just kind of, I guess, you know, you're culturally, you're just taught certain ways. Like Americans are very big on, like, I remember I had a group of people where everyone's trying to give each other advice. And it's like, you have a problem at work. Well, the American answer is always, well, take the person, sit down and talk with them, have it out. And for someone from a Soviet background, it's like, no. The first question is, well, what power does this person have? Because they might smile and nod at the meeting, but then they'll stab you in the back later. Are they going to, you know, start a file on you? This is the kind of psychology that develops in these countries. And this is something Americans, I think, are thankfully very naive about how vindictive and petty small bureaucrats often can be. And sadly, I think some Americans are starting to learn the true nature of that. And a good example of this is when the parents were protesting about the stuff being taught to their kids, and now the parents were under investigation and being labeled as terrorists or being alluded to as terrorists. This is the sort of thing that Americans just never think of, but it's like, yes, the government will, if the government can arrest terrorists, very quickly, everyone who they don't like becomes a terrorist.
Yeah, I'm somebody who, you know, there have been two moments, I think, politically for me that have really shifted, you could say, my Overton window or my perception of the country and what we are up against. The first one was actually Kavanaugh, not even because it's like, oh my gosh, Supreme Court, so much is at stake, that the Kamala Harris was among them, that the most powerful voices in the Democrat Party and the Democrat Senate at the time were willing to clearly, erroneously, and without any basis in any fact or any reality, call a man a rapist in front of his family and the whole country just because they didn't want him to have a job. That means they do it to your dad. That means they do it to your brother. They do it to anybody and feel good about themselves too. It does not matter. It did not matter to them. And then with COVID as well, the immiseration of millions of people, the deaths of despair that occurred as a result, the businesses that were destroyed, the livelihoods that were ruined. I mean, we go down the whole list. Not only were there people going along with all this, and this was the part of it that really rocked me as a New Yorker. It's why I'm no longer a New Yorker. People thought they were happy. They were like, oh, we're great. We're the good people. The monsters thought that they were the heroes, Michael. That's the problem.
But Buck, I'm going to push back a little bit, and I don't think you're going to disagree. The Democrats should have patted themselves on the back about Kavanaugh because none of them faced any consequences whatsoever for what they did other than fundraising and being regarded as leaders of a movement. Chuck Grassley, who was either the chairman or the ranking member of the Judiciary Committee, has sent out press releases. I point out this story all the time, how he wrote letters to, I think, the Justice Department and either the FBI or CIA demanding answers as to how Julie Swetnick, who had no connection whatsoever to Kavanaugh, who was claiming that multiple gang rape parties she attended, he was somehow responsible for. Avenatti, her attorney, went to jail. They couldn't get her on CNN fast enough. Grassley wrote a letter being like, what are the consequences for this woman? And in his press release, he's boasting that his letters for a couple of years have now been ignored. So when you have one party that is willing to do this, and the Republican response is, well, I'm going to write a sternly worded letter and no one's going to answer me and I'm fighting for you. When you have this asymmetry, of course, the incentives are always going to be as tyrannical as possible because there's no downside.
I don't disagree with you. So that one coming. But let me ask you, we're going to take a pause, Michael, because I want to put in a word from our sponsor. But a question I want to put out there that you can think about and we'll come back to in a second. How close in ethos, how close in sentiment are the most radical elements of the Democrat Party in this country and your average Soviet commissar circa 1950? Let's pick a time. But I want to come back to that in a second. Born from the tragedy of 9/11, the Tunnel to Towers Foundation has been honoring America's heroes ever since. Look, it's a really important organization that honors fallen and severely injured heroes and their families with mortgage-free homes. This year alone, hundreds of Gold Star and fallen first responder families with young children and our nation's most severely injured veterans and first responders are receiving homes. More than 500 homeless veterans received housing and services last year. And more than 1,500 are receiving housing and services this year. Through the Tunnel to Towers 9/11 Institute, the foundation is educating kids in kindergarten through 12th grade about our nation's darkest day. Join Tunnel to Towers on its mission to do good. Please help America to never forget its greatest heroes. Join me in donating $11 a month to Tunnel to Towers at T2T.org. That's T, the number 2T.org. All right, Michael, returning to our question, how close are the, not even the most radical, how close are the administrative elements of the Democrat Party in this country to the apparatus of the Soviets?
I think I'm going to duck the question a little bit, but give you an answer you'll be happy with. I think the Democratic Party and the members of the Democratic Party are far more moderate and mainstream than the members of the corporate press. I had a poll on my Twitter once and I said, if you had, these are two choices people watching the show won't like, but if you had to choose to be the Supreme Court and you had the choices were 9 random Democratic senators or 9 random members of the New York Times editorial board, which would you choose? And I think it was like 80-20 in favor of the Democratic Senate. The New York Times and all these agencies, they're the ones who are making the Democratic Party wag. It's not the other way around. And I'll give you an example that demonstrates this point. Let's suppose I'm a Democratic Party congressman. I hate Trump. I think he's the worst. He's praising white nationalists, Charles, all the other nonsense, you know, the whole rigmarole. Yeah, sure. At the same time, I don't think he committed any impeachable offenses. I think he shouldn't be president. He's terrible, so on and so forth. How could I go in front of my constituents as a Democratic congressperson when 24/7 they're hearing Trump, Russia collusion, Ukraine phone call, so on and so forth, and say, guys, he's horrible, the worst president ever, but that's not enough for impeachment. I would not be in that position. So that demonstrates who has the power on the left intellectually in this country. It is far more that the media, who is accountable to no one, as opposed to every day, Mitch McConnell, Nancy Pelosi, and Kevin McCarthy, and Chuck Schumer will tell you how the other person's terrible. No one is holding the New York Times or the Washington Post accountable other than idiots like myself on Twitter. So that, to me, is the far bigger concern. So, and as to the apparatchiks in the 50s, they didn't really care. They weren't ideologues. It's like, or I think it's Upton Sinclair is a big character in this book, and there's a quote ascribed to him where it's almost impossible to teach a man to believe something when his salary depends on him not believing it. Mm-hmm. If I'm in the 1950s and the only way I could get food is to parrot Stalinism, and if I slip up, that sword's going to kill me and my family, I'll be singing louder than everybody else. You know, and the old saying goes, you don't want to be the first one to stop clapping for Stalin. So I think people need to appreciate that a lot of times these entities and these organizations aren't a function literally of ideology so much as people responding to very perverse incentives. And often those incentives are a matter of life and death for them and their families.
I also think that there are things, you get into some of them in the book in terms of the level of awfulness, the everyday awfulness too. It's not, yes, bad things will happen in a lot of countries, but you'll remember them as, well, that was an awful moment, you know, that was something terrible that happened, but it was just every day, right? The everyday awfulness of living under the Soviet regime. But there are also stories that I think people just they just refuse to believe. And I think it's so interesting that in the Death of Stalin, which, you know, is a pretty well-made movie for what it is, that whole sequence in the beginning where Stalin calls in and wants a copy, however they did it, you know, old school records, I forget what it is, but wanted a copy of the you know, Moscow orchestra performance, and they had already finished. They did wake up the conductor and bring everyone back and do a re-recording of it. Like, they brought everybody back, and I believe they even tried to bring back members of the audience too. So they had a performance at the main theater, and I think it was Moscow, might have been St. Petersburg, but I think it was Moscow, and they actually brought everybody back. And people were like, there's no way that actually happened. That actually did happen, because everyone was terrified if they didn't do it, he was going to have their family killed, as well as the, you know, all the horrible things that you can imagine. That was life for people.
Yeah, the artists are, you know, had a particularly tough time, because if anything can be perceived as in any way not praising the system enough. We see that even here with the political correctness to a far lesser extent. Obviously, people aren't getting murdered, but there's this one story. I want to get the exact details here of there was a play that Stalin didn't like. And basically overnight, you know, your career is just ruined. People can be sent away. Everyone who's ever been associated with you, gets, I'm trying to get the exact, I think it was Shostakovich. I want to get it exactly here. Yeah. Shostakovich. It was in 1936. You know, he had a play called the Lady Macbeth of Mtsensk. There were articles about it 2 days later. And the community stood up for him because Shostakovich was and remains one of the great composers of all time. Stalin just didn't happen to like one. As a consequence of this, so the director's wife, he stayed with the director's house. Her wife was stabbed to death in the eyes. When a marshal of the Soviet Union, this guy's very high up, Tukhachevsky, he was defended Shostakovich. He was tortured and shot. His body was sent to a landfill. The librettist of the performance was arrested and shot. His ex-girlfriend vanished. His brother-in-law, who was a physicist, his sister, his mother-in-law, and his uncle, they were all arrested just because Stalin didn't like this play. So, you know, to your point, it's not that people were living in fear of, like, you know, maybe Buck, you had this tweet in college and crap, what if someone finds a screenshot and it's going to look bad for my career? You're newly married. I've met your brothers. If something happens to you, or if they can't get to you, but let's suppose I want to get to Buck. I don't need to get to Buck. I've got a circle around you. And let me tell you, everyone listening to this can imagine themselves being tough and there's nothing they can do to me. You could arrest me. I'm not going to break. Bring in your wife. Bring in your brothers. Put them in that cell. See what happens. And this is something I think in the West, we're so correctly proud of our respect for the individual and individual rights. It never even enters our head that innocent people who are simply family members, it's not only automatically that they're targets, it's the law. It was a crime, a felony, to be married to an enemy of the people. And if you're arrested, you're okay, enemy of the people. It's like, you can't defend yourself. You know, the spouse can't say, well, I wasn't really arrested, married to them. And right away, what happens also is the children become orphans. And there was a lot of hand-wringing in the Kremlin because all these kids started killing themselves with good reason. Because overnight, they were orphans and no one would associate with them, because why are you taking in a child of the enemy of the people? So the level of depravity and evil in these societies is so much worse than just like, oh, someone's this fat guy, like, you know, some fat buffoon on the top and it's his brother gets a pay cut and you're hungry and you have to learn stupid things at school. Oh, please. Like, that is nothing. That's totally scratching the surface of what's going on in these societies.
Yeah, I think that people also don't spend enough time, or it's not thought of very often how much North Korea really tried in many ways. Yes, they're a huge, you know, there's people make the case that actually a racist Japanese imperial mindset was borrowed by essentially an ultra-nationalist, ultra-racial identity as part of North Korean ideology, but also in terms of the machinery of North Korea and how the Communist Party or whatever operates there is borrowed from the Soviets. I mean, very, you know, even the fashion choices in a lot of ways. You can say they're borrowed from China too, but guess what? The Chinese communists borrowed them from the Soviets.
Not borrowed, implanted. You know, yeah, it was just directly imported. In fact, a friend of mine, Peter, when he was looking at my photos of North Korea, he was just blown away. He goes, "This looks like where I grew up, but there's Asian people walking around." Like, he couldn't wrap his head around it. It looked identical to him. So this is one of the reasons I went to North Korea. It's like, all right, this is my only chance to see what it was like for my family, you know, 70 or 80 years ago. And let me assure everyone, it's no picnic, to put it mildly, although we did have a picnic.
I'm Jack Armstrong. He's Joe Getty. We're the Armstrong and Getty Show.
We cover the stories the mainstream media ignores.
Stories that are important to your life and important to the world.
The election, of course.
The many trials of Donald Trump.
Couple of wars.
Gender-bending madness.
Why are kids looking at so much social media?
And we bring you the stories the mainstream media is on.
But we do it without the left-wing media spin.
Listen to Armstrong and Getty On Demand on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Open your free iHeart app and search the Armstrong and Getty Show to start listening.
Yeah. What? How does a society fall into this stuff? I mean, because that's always the, you know, we look at the understanding the scope of the problem and understanding how awful it was. And we're far away from that. And I mean, I'm always amazed, too. I read about, you know, what is it? The Conquest, the Robert Conquest book, where he talks about the Great Purge. Right. And how all the academics initially, you know, in the West, we're saying that, oh, it wasn't that bad. And it's actually even worse than anybody had anticipated. But the entirety of Western world academia was essentially trying to cover up or certainly vastly diminish what happened there. We don't learn these things enough. But also, what is the tipping point? Right. Because people are sitting here. I was just saying before, I mean, COVID was the closest thing I've ever felt like in this country to we may actually be living in a totalitarian state at some point. I didn't think it was underway, right? I mean, sitting at home ordering, you know, watching Netflix, getting Uber Eats. But the mentality that people had was scary. I mean, people that are you know, masking up their three-year-old and are willing to scream at people if they get within, you know, 10 feet of them because they're so scared of them. Like, there was something dramatically wrong with tens of millions of people in this country.
I don't think there was something dramatically wrong. I think there remains something dramatically wrong that was activated. I don't think those people's psychology changed as a consequence of COVID going away. I think COVID gave an excuse for people who have neurosis or anxiety or other some kind of things that are suboptimal mental conditions to have a rationalization that's external and an opportunity to act out their aggression and hysteria toward others. And to your point about the intellectuals, Theodore Dreiser, who is probably the greatest naturalist writer of all time, like, he was discussing what was going on in the Soviet Union, and he just basically concluded, what good would freeing those prisoners do? So this was something, and we see this still today with many people who are pro-government to such an extent, that they have this guinea pig of society. It's like, all right, let's try this experiment over there. If it doesn't work out, at least we'll have the data. And, you know, Ayn Rand, who opens up the book with her testifying in front of Congress, she had this great quote. She was on Donahue in 1979. And he goes, "Why are you so harsh on these people? Like, why can't you just say that you disagree?" And she goes, "Because they don't hesitate to sacrifice whole nations." Like, they don't, I think this is something Americans like don't really get, the depth of evil. They don't care if literally millions of people die or are tortured or starved because they have this idea of how society should run. And there's nothing that's going to stop them from feeling important and having their worldview imposed on infinitely innocent people. And by definition, in their mindset, if you are opposed to their machinations, you are no longer innocent. And therefore, whatever happens to you, it's your fault.
I actually think you see that reality. You see flashes of it with a lot of the climate change stuff. Climate change is a religious belief now. I mean, they play all these games. You don't believe in climate change. You say, well, climate's been changing forever. Of course, the climate's changing. Climate change is a religious belief. But you see it, though, because if you start to say, hey, you realize if we radically decarbonized, that there's still about a billion people, right, give or take, that are in pretty dire poverty globally. It used to be a lot more. The good news is that, you know, global poverty is in the last 50 to the last 75 years down by leaps and bounds, but there's still about a billion people. If you do this stuff and you were to actually enforce these rules about CO2, there would be a lot of people without enough food to eat. A lot of people would not only die of starvation, but just a whole lot more people die of the malnutrition and the other components of, you know, being able to live in a prosperous society. Even if you don't die necessarily from lack of food, if you don't have enough food, your health is dramatically impacted, etc. Michael, they don't blink when you, they're just like, yeah, but I mean, you know, we're trying to save CO2 emissions, man. Like, we're trying to save the world here. And I actually think I think they're scary. I think they don't realize they're frightening, but they're terrifying in a way.
Well, because there's no mind there. I forget which African country, but when the lockdowns were happening, there was one country where they're like, if we lock down, we die. We don't have fridges. We don't have stores of food. We're living hand to mouth. We need to go farm and get today's food. And basically it was like, we'll let them eat cake. So, you know, what you're speaking of, again, I think it's so much more malevolent than people realize. And again, the reason why Americans especially don't realize how malevolent it is that there's an entire information superstructure designed in place to teach us since kindergarten that people are basically good, and that when people in power do bad things, maybe there's like some bad corrupt CEO or some mayor who's on the take and Aaron Brockovich is going to come in and put him in his place. But for the most part, everyone sure makes mistakes, but no one is inherently evil. And if you think that they are, you're a deranged conspiracy theorist. And when you have this as your basis for evaluating politics and people in power and governments and so on and so forth, it's almost impossible to realize how little those in places like this value human life. And if the choice is between their position and thousands of people suffering, you know, horrors, it's almost a joke to them. It's like, well, what's the catch? You know what I mean? Like, they don't, if anything, they feel powerful that they can wave their hand and have so many people kiss the ring.
Well, this is, I mean, again, another area that I think illustrates this really well is the very obvious positioning of really well-off to very wealthy white liberals on things like police. Especially, and I know you're not a big female police guy, but on...
No, especially females.
Yeah, on issues of criminal justice. I mean, you know, if we do have a population that is not supposed to be policing itself, which is what we do, even though we do have some, you know, people caring, the notion that you would condemn people living in high violence, 90% plus minority neighborhoods to living with even more violence, so that, you know, you can go to a Nancy Pelosi fundraiser and then hang out with a bunch of like producers for Netflix shows and have your Chardonnay glasses and feel good about yourself. They do not care. Even when I try to explain this to libs who are very, you know, who think that they're very attuned to things, when I tell them that your BLM marches and you're giving money to these organizations and all this stuff makes you feel good, there will be more people who are dead because of what that position is. They do not care. It does not affect them. I mean, look at the whole Democrat Party. It doesn't affect them until it comes time for elections. Then all of a sudden they pretend that they never said these things.
I'm going to say something about the police that I'm sure you're going to agree with. My problem with the police is things like Kenosha, where not only are they refusing to do their jobs, which is in and of itself a problem when, you know, massive unrest is happening and police things are being torn down, it's that they were punishing people who were trying to do their jobs for them. Kyle Rittenhouse, when he turned himself in, was pepper sprayed by the cops. And then they put him a show trial. If they had their druthers, he'd be in jail for life. And even if he got off, there's no one who's listening who can tell me that being arrested and having the death sentence over your head isn't a traumatic experience for literally anybody. So that's my issue with the police that I'm sure you're going to agree with. That's the problem.
No, I don't disagree with that either. I actually want to take a moment here for capitalism, Mike, if I can. The MyPillow 2.0, which is amazing. I've got them here at home. Patented adjustable fill of the original MyPillow, but now brand new exclusive fabric made with temperature regulating thread. This stuff is great. I love it. Carrie loves it. We're sleeping on our MyPillow 2.0s every night. The softest, smoothest, coolest pillow you'll ever own. The MyPillow 2.0 comes at a great deal right now. Buy one, get one free for a limited time when you use promo code BUCK. That's promo code BUCK. MyPillow 2.0, like I said, temperature regulating thread, 100% made here in the USA. MyPillow comes with a 10-year warranty and a 60-day money-back guarantee. So go to MyPillow.com, click on the radio listener square, get this buy one, get one free offer in the MyPillow 2.0. Enter promo code BUCK. That's promo code B-U-C-K for the MyPillow 2.0.
And you know what happens when you get the MyPillow? You get a free copy of Mike Lindell's book called From Crackhead to CEO, and it's a lenticular cover, and it changes from his crackhead face to his like professional smiling CEO face. It's really cool.
I have a copy of it here. Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's amazing. Yeah. Mike is an incredible American success story. I mean, when you think about, when you think about a crack addiction, which short of opioid addiction is probably one of the very hardest, I think, to be.
That's because it's so good. They're not using crack because they don't like it.
I mean, look, the opioid receptors in the brain, there's apparently nothing. And this is why it's so dangerous, right? There's nothing that feels, and Mike has been way too, I'm talking about Mike Malice, by the way, for anybody. Mike Malice has been way too well behaved this whole interview, by the way. He's had his thinking cap on, talking history.
Am I wrong, though?
He hasn't said anything yet to just intentionally try to get me in trouble, which is one of his favorite games. Because then I go, because if I don't say it, he says something and I go, oh, I keep going. And then I get my people who are like, well, how could you let him say that? I'm like, it's Malice.
Buck, if you started smoking crack, your dad could become president.
Well,
ever think about that?
I did not think about that until now. That's actually an interesting point. Also, Hunter Biden, by the way, you'd think like kind of a spoiled, connected kid. Crack is not usually the option.
No. That's not,
you know? Yeah.
It's such a low class gutter drug. And the guy has money. And he's trashy, but not in the crack trashy way. You would think he'd be a junkie, maybe a cokehead. I don't know what's going on in that household, but it's very rare that these children of privilege become crackheads.
Do you, Hunter Biden, do you think he's going to get, you know, that's who we're talking about here. Do you think he's going to get prosecuted?
No, I don't think there's ever consequences for a Democratic Party people. Never really one direction.
I have an on-air bet over this. I was like, Clay, he already owes me one steak dinner and he has doubled down. Because he said last year, Hunter Biden's going to get indicted. I said, Clay, that's crazy. And we bet a stake on air. So this is all very public. Everyone knows. I won. Now he wants to do a double. And I'm like, how many stakes? I mean, fortunately, Clay's got plenty of money. But I was like, how many stakes of yours am I going to take?
The one who got put away, two of them, Rob Blagojevich and Kwame Kilpatrick. I think Kilpatrick was the last name. Both went to jail. And Trump commuted or pardoned both of them. So not only do the Democrats never go to jail, when the Democrats do go to jail, the Republicans let them out.
You know, you just reminded me, actually, since I want to just start getting people angry at me and get in trouble here. What happens in the Republican election? What happens in the primary? What happens in the general 2024, given where things are right now? What do you see happening?
I think it's going to be, I'm shocked at to what extent Trump is going full bore against DeSantis this early. I think he only knows how to do offense, which is not a bad thing. I'm very much for doing offense. I think he is in a lot of trouble because it is now, there's an excuse for me, if I'm Facebook, if I'm CNN, Fox, to be like, the guy fomented an insurrection, I can't give him airtime. So this is the first time, I think, in like recent history where there is some kind of corporate explanation for not taking a candidate's money. And that is something that's a real big handicap. He used Twitter to get elected president. For him to leave that money on the table, to me, I'm not his advisor, obviously, seems crazy. And I'm also, I think people underestimate that the biggest issue Trump is facing, in my opinion, in 2024 is the Republican Party establishment. And here's the other thing. If he became president, Mitch McConnell would team up with the Democrats in 2 seconds to get him removed from office. And they'd have those 67 votes quite easily, in my opinion.
Wow. Interesting.
Am I wrong?
This one, because... never mind 2016, 2022 makes it feel like any prediction can be, it's a fool's game.
Do you think that Mitch McConnell cares far more about his relationship with Chuck Schumer and Joe Biden than he does about the people of Kentucky?
Yes, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's very true. So you think Trump probably wins the primary against DeSantis? No, you don't.
I think I think they're going to do whatever they can to screw him out of the situation, including, if necessary, excluding him from the debates. It's not going to be like 2016. And I also think they've been successful in making him radioactive enough that it's going to be very hard for him to hire quality people. Because think about it. If I've got a good resume, right, why am I ruining my life for the sake of this guy who, once the campaign's over, if I quit, he's going to go on Truth Central and talk about what an idiot I am. So it's going to be very hard for him to get. And staffing, I think even his biggest supporters admit, was a huge issue for him throughout his White House. He's the one hiring Fauci and John Bolton and Jared Kushner and every other, you know, Reince Priebus. None of these are particularly MAGA type people, to put it mildly. So I think this is going to be a major issue for him going forward.
What's the, so you finished the book, Back to the White Pill here, and it's this way we can bring our discussion to a close this time until you invite me on the Michael Malice show, which has not happened. I don't think it's happened since COVID. I'm just going to call you out right now. I don't think I've been on.
Well, Malice. I try to have likable guests.
Wow. See, that's what he does. I'm just going to tweet that clip out. So everybody's like, see, he's so
Please
mean.
Do. To then people would actually see it.
Yeah.
I'll retweet it.
So the white pill, you say at the end, is effectively that while it is not guaranteed effectively that we have to lose to tyranny, we can fight, right? We can keep fighting. So what does that look like for us here?
There's a lot of people in the West and in America who thinks America's a wrap, that it's doomed, so on and so forth. One of my biggest points is, how do you look at Mitch McConnell and Kamala Harris and Joe Biden and John Fetterman and say to yourself, I can't beat these people. They're too important and smart and powerful. When you put in those terms, you realize what an absurdity it is. And something that you and I completely in lockstep agreement are, is that if there's any glimmer of hope for a better future for ourselves and our families, we have to do whatever we can to fight for that future. Even if, you know, we lose, at least when you meet your maker, you could be like, I did the best I could with what I had. And there are so many forces, especially in the Republican Party, who want you to settle, who want you to compromise, who are like, guys, grow up, be rational, be realistic. None of this is going anywhere. You have to work within the system. And this is just always how it's been. Those people are the most dangerous ones, because they're the ones trying to get you to get down on your knees voluntarily instead of being forced to.
The White Pill is the book, the tale of good and evil. Michael Malice tells a good tale. Good to be with you, sir. Thanks for hanging.
Always a pleasure, Buck.
Since 9/11, the Tunnel to Towers Foundation has been committed to supporting our nation's first responders and veterans, heroes who put their lives on the line for our communities and our country. Heroes like U.S. Army Major Jonathan Turnbull. Major Turnbull sustained devastating injuries at the hands of an ISIS suicide bomber. The complete loss of his left eye, a puncture to his right eye, he needed more than 20 surgeries and countless hours of rehabilitation. Tunnel to Towers paid off his mortgage and gave him a specially adapted smart home designed for his needs. He moves around his home more easily now. His home also gives him hope. With help from people like you, the foundation supports families like the Turnbulls. Join Tunnel to Towers in supporting America's heroes, our nation's catastrophically injured veterans and first responders, homeless veterans, Gold Star families, and the families of fallen first responders. Donate $11 a month to Tunnel to Towers at T2T.org. That's T, the number 2, T.org. 95 cents of every dollar goes directly to their programs.